Reynolds, who have not finished races well in the past, are going to do it today. Here they come another time.
Welcome to F1WP.com. My name is Mark Rogers. I'm the host of the program.
I've been a fun fan for years.
F1WP.com podcast.
We're going to do tire changes maybe next year. I think we can.
Hi, this is Desiree. I'm your fabulous, fierce female Formula One fan.
Welcome to F1Weekly.com. My name is Clark Rogers. I'm the host of the program. I'll be joined by Steve Faub, my co-host. This is podcast number 1114, September 29th, 2025. Steven?
This F1Weekly podcast is brought to you by Yahoo Ads. Yahoo Ads get you the F1Weekly.com website for the ads and interest you. From cars to car parts, Yahoo Ads gets you everything that you could possibly want. Click on them. You know you want to.
Thank you, Steve, and thank you, Yahoo Ads. On today's program, Max doesn't stop. Taking the win at the Nürburgring in his Ferrari GT3 debut. Yep, this man is out of control. Grosjean goes down memory lane. We're all pulling for Roscoe, LCH. Yeah, we are. Hey, I have a dog. Love him very much. And Fernando prepares for the long-awaited retirement at the end of 2026. And this week's Nasser Hamid Corner, we have his last favorite big interview. I'm replaying the Dr. Marco interview. This was a really big, big deal. But with Max Verstappen completely out of control, Red Bull's resurging, the loss of Christian Horner, I thought we need to revisit Dr. Marco's opinions and personality. So absolutely, this is a great interview. You will enjoy that. And yes, indeed, we do need your contributions. Keep this program on the air. Just click on the Support F1 Weekly tab. You know, you want to. So there you have it. Thousands of people watched this six-hour endurance race at the Green Hell, the Nordschleife, and Max Verstappen wins on his debut, but not to be unexpected because he is what you call a phenomenon. So very impressive, and of course, he's going to be taking this momentum, this winning fury into Singapore, and we know who is going to be very conservative or aggressive. We'll see what they choose, but McLaren really has to do something with their two drivers, and of course, we need to see Leclerc and Lewis Hamilton and Ferrari, of course, succeed. So we have a lot on the plate next week, so this week we're going to shoot right into this fantastic interview that was done in Austria in Dr. Marco's hotel in Graz. I want everybody to dig it and enjoy this.
This edition of F1 Weekly Podcast is brought to you by Yahoo Ads. From Milka Duno to Turbo Renault. Click on them. You know you want to.
Nas, welcome to the studio. How are you doing?
I am doing very good, sir. Thank you. And I have to say greetings and rates and regards from Schlossberg Hotel, owned and operated by Dr. Helmut Marko. You know, he owns four hotels in this town. I met him this morning at 9 a.m., and his office is right across the hotel. Mr. Rogers. His first question to me was, what is your ethnic background? And I was going to say Norway or North Korea, but since I had not even asked a single question, I thought good idea would be just to keep it real. But, you know, he was very nice, and he was kind enough to agree to a 20-minute session. But as soon, you know, the problem this day and age, even with juniors in Formula 4, when you do an interview, especially if they are in the, you know, junior program of any racing team, and most of the good ones are, the press person also sits with you. And of course, they keep an eye on what you're saying, and you don't go beyond the time given to you. So what happened, I was taken to his office by his secretary, Miss Vicky Katnick, and then she left the room. And as soon as she did that, I said, yeah, well, this may go to another 5-10 minutes. When it was over, we had 50 minutes of wonderful stories from Dr. Marco. You know, he went to see his first Formula One race in 1961 at the Nürburgring with his school friend Jochen Rindt. And next week, we will post this interview as a special Dr. Marco podcast. And we talked about a lot of things, Montoya, Targa Florio, Max, Sebastian, Ford. And only person who did not come up in the conversation was Fernando Alonso. And I have to say, Dr. Marco is a funny guy, because I asked him about a couple of things that I had seen on YouTube from his ex-drivers, and he was a good sport about it. And this is one example. Here he is talking about one of his young drivers who raced for him in Formula 3000, then went on to win Formula One races for a couple of teams. When you had your Formula 3000 team, one of your drivers was Juan Pablo Montoya. Was he a hot potato, difficult to handle and manage? And how good was his son, Sebastian, who was also in your program?
Juan Pablo, he came here to Graz. The first thing he told me that which McDonald's of the four, I didn't know that we have four McDonald's in Graz, is the best. So his sort of food was unhealthy. He was a lazy bastard.
Lazy bastard?
Yeah. But he was unbelievably fast.
Yes.
Unbelievably fast. And he did so many stupid mistakes. You know, we were leading in Truxton, or it was the first race in England, I can't remember. We were leading in Finland, and he crashed. So that's similar to his son, but his son is crashing not in the front, he's crashing more in the top 10 and so on. So we had a hard time with him for quite a lot of times. We didn't even talk to each other. But now we are good friends, and yeah, he wasted his talent. He could have been multiply world champion. His son, unfortunately, doesn't have this ultimate speed like Juan Pablo, but he compensates it with crashes. He's nearly every race, unfortunately.
Gracias, Señor Montoya.
Hi, I'm Juan Pablo Montoya, and you're listening to F1 Weekly.
Welcome back to F1Weekly.com. Clark Rogers here, your host. And now, as we spin the globe and go around the world with Motorsports Mondial and the king, the Swami himself, Nasser Hamid.
Thank you, sir. Greetings and racing regards from Scarperia, where Mugello Circuit is located. Very pleased to present this conversation with Red Bull advisor Dr. Helmut Marko.
Thank you, Nasser. On today's program, Nasser continues his interview tour of Europe. Since we had no race last weekend, we bring you a special strudel from Austria. An exciting treat. Yes, the interview of interviews with Dr. Helmut Marko. Nasser?
Thank you, sir. My sincere thanks to his assistant, Miss Vicky Katnick, in making this possible. And of course, to Dr. Marko for giving me 30 more minutes than was requested. That was very kind. This is a long, serious historical conversation. I hope our listeners enjoy this. Here we go with Dr. Marko.
Okay, folks, I'm here in beautiful and historical city of Graz in Austria with one and only Dr. Helmut Marko. Dr. Marko, first of all, thank you so much for your time. How are you today?
I'm fine. I'm enjoying the hot weather in Austria after a winter day in Silverstone.
Now, we had very exciting last two races at Silverstone and Red Bull Ring. Competition is catching up. What is the game plan for rest of the season? And I ask this question because Max is not one of those drivers who will just cruise and collect for points.
We are struggling at the moment. We don't have the fastest car the moment, but we have Max, and that makes a difference. But we have to catch up again. McLaren, since their update in Miami, is the most competitive cars. The McLaren is fast everywhere under all conditions. And now Mercedes, it looks like they have also catched up. I mean, Silverstone, I would say, is an indicator how good the car is because it's low temperatures and so on. But we are bringing an update, and hopefully this update is a success so we can run again what we are used from the top of the field and controlling it. At the moment, we are, I would say, on the back foot. We have problems with the setup. It takes too long to find the right balance. But still, lucky enough, we could extend the championship lead for Max and in the constructors. But that is mainly because the people or the teams behind us, they are changing. Once it's Ferrari, then it's McLaren, then it's Mercedes. So it's always something different who is challenging us. And that makes why we are 81 points ahead.
Now, as far as your package is concerned, where is the competition catching up? Is it more on the engine side or on the chassis development?
I think engine-wise, it's between Ferrari, Mercedes, and Honda. It's not a game changer. Looks like the Ferrari has the fastest engine, but it's marginal. It's on the chassis side. Sorry. And as I said, it takes us too long to find the proper setup. We are not fast with every type of tires. You know, like in Silverstone, we were struggling with a medium tire very much. On the fast tire, we were competitive again. So the main thing is to get the tires in the right window.
Okay. I saw a couple of helmets in the reception area of your hotel where I'm staying in, which is very nice, belonging to Seb and Max. Now, Seb won 4 championships in a row for Red Bull. Now, Max is on his way to doing the same. What are the similarities and differences between these two great champions, both discovered by you?
Each driver is different, you know, and I don't really compare. But Seb is a driver who is working into each detail and needs a lot of technical feedback before he goes fast. But once he has everything under control, yeah, he's delivering. Max is a more natural driver. He just jumps in the car and is quick. But, of course, nowadays, without going into details, technical details, you can't survive, you can't succeed. From the natural, Max is, he's just in his racing, you know, after a Grand Prix, he jumps on a sim racing, very difficult for me to understand, but he likes it. And he's also in sports, very interested. He knows a lot about football, you know, he knows the nearly the coaches and everything which is happening. So he is completely focused in the sports world. And from the personalities, both have their own opinion and they also are not shy to speak it out. But it is in a different way. Now Sebastian Vettel is going more on the green side. Like Max, he just wants to have the fastest, the best car. And he lives his own life. But the commitment of Max is so unbelievable. And you see it on the starts sometimes, or his overtakings. It's so poof. He doesn't go left, right, or anything. He watches, and then he makes a move. So, and also a difference is changing conditions. That's normally, or that's one of the greatest advantages of Max, when he doesn't need any warm-up, he just poof. And that's, I think, he had a very good education through Jos, his father, in go-kart, a very tough one, I would say, but we see the result.
Yes. Now, I understand Max's performance in a Formula 3 race in the rain at Nürburgring convinced you he was a special talent. Tell us what you saw that weekend on a street circuit, and was there any concern about putting him in Formula 1 with only 1 year of single-seater, and was Mr. Mateschitz fully supportive of your decision?
Nürburgring is a street circuit with basically one, two, three, four corners. So it's not a real racetrack. And it was raining, drying, raining again. And Max was a second, 2 seconds faster than anybody else. Where the others were braking, he was shifting up. And he had such an amazing car control. At that time, we had been already in negotiations about the future, if we could have a cooperation. It was mainly to put him into Formula 2. There was competition from Mercedes. And after this race, I rang Jos the next morning and said, forget all our discussions, and we will go straight to Formula 1. When I had him on the phone, Jos, he was silent. So, Jos, are you still here? You know? So it took a while before he answered. And so that was, yeah, the moment where I decided this is the guy who could do it. I had a call with Mr. Mateschitz, explained him also the risk, because he was at that time 16 years old. There were some criticism or even big criticism. I said, okay, we are there to make stars, not to buy stars. You know, that was his philosophy about. And we knew we had with Franz Tost, a very experienced team principal. He prepared a program for him. He had some, at that time, testing was easier. He had some outings in some of these Italian circuits, you know. Can't know the
Mugello name. Or Misano?
Misano Adriatico, yeah. Exactly. Yeah, you know. And then came the day where we put him on a Friday drive, and it happened, it was Suzuka, you know, one of the fastest and most difficult circuits we have in the whole calendar. So now they thought we're becoming already criminal, you know, with some of our critics. So he went in the car, he went flat in R100, the corner in Suzuka, the fast one.
R130?
Yeah. Flat after four laps or so. He did a very competitive time, didn't do anything wrong. And from there on, the critics didn't stop, but it was much less. Yeah, and then, of course, in the first year, there had been some mistakes he made. He made one crazy thing. He overtook, I don't know whom, but the outside on Blanchimont. You know, that's a really fast corner. Yeah. And so I said, don't do that again, because that's something which is, it's just too dangerous. Yeah, and then he did what we expected from him. He learned much quicker than we thought. And then when Kiat was struggling, he had a very good first season at Red Bull Racing, but the second year he was really struggling. And then we decided to make a change, which, again, was not supported by many people. And Max, okay, he had luck because the two Mercedes guys crashed, but he was holding off Raikkonen, I think, for 30 laps.
Yeah, with the Raikkonen even at DRS.
He drove a fantastic smart already in his first race with Red Bull Racing. He was slowing down where Raikkonen couldn't overtake, and he was pushing. That was the last two corners to the straight, so he had the necessary distance so Raikkonen couldn't overtake. So, and that was the victory first.
I watched all his races, and also used to watch Formula 3 on, still do, on YouTube. Do you remember him winning all three races at Spa?
Yeah, and you know, he didn't win the championship. So, or some people thought Ocon won the championship, so he's a better one. But he had, first of all, he had engine troubles, and at that time, if you had an engine failure, you were 10 places penalty for three races or so. And this Spa race, overtaking on the outside again, you know, it was amazing.
Yeah. Okay, when Max first came into Formula One, you were quoted as saying, only driver you can compare Max to is Senna. I would like to get your opinion on Senna when he was racing, and did you ever meet him?
I met him quite often. I can't remember the year when Berger was with McLaren as well. Mm-hmm. And he got the feeling that it didn't get the same material. So I was, I think, nearly all the Grand Prix going, observing. And after two races, I told Berger, Berger, most of the time, first session, he was faster than Senna, and then Senna came and was the man who dominated. So I learned how he is working. For example, Imola at that time, there was 30 cars on the grid, and in the first lap of free practice, and there were about 10 Italians, you know, so they were more than enthusiastic. And he was going through them, attacking them, like it would be the last lap of a Grand Prix. So I thought, well, what is he doing? And it was on purpose. He was teaching them, you know, if Senna is coming, you move, you have to move. And in the races you saw, when he came for lapping, when they saw the yellow helmet, everybody went to the side. So that was one thing. And another thing was, I was sitting in Suzuka on the third corner, so up in the grandstand, very high. And Berger was in the first session and in the second session faster than Senna there. And when I came back in the paddock having some dinner or whatsoever, he came to me and said, what am I doing wrong here? So, you know, I was sitting up on one of the last rows and he recognized me. So you see this white picture he had. Another example, I just noticed he was on a Japanese engineer and arguing about fuel consumption, but it was not about the lead. It was a tenth of a gram. And he said, no, I won't, and check and check. And the guy said, why are you so? He said, it's in the end, it's 5 kilos or so, or 3 kilos, and that is, I don't know, maybe 2 seconds or 3 seconds. So in each detail, he wanted to get the maximum driving, performance, engine setup, and so on. But he was a very committed, but also a very charismatic personality.
Interesting. Okay, you have some very talented junior drivers like Arvid Lindblad, who won both Formula 3 races at Silverstone, Isaac Hedjar, who now leads the Formula 2 championship, and Liam Lawson. Now, with all due respect to them, I don't think any of them will bother Max if they were teammates. Do you agree with my humble opinion?
First of all, I'm not looking for a new Max, because Max is unique. And it will be difficult for all of them to be teammates, but we have a situation where our second driver, unfortunately, isn't performing as he should. So we will have an evaluation in the summer break, what we are going to do. Lindblad is only 16 years old, so it's difficult to say, but you saw the race in Silverstone, the feature race, where he had enormous pressure from Mini, who is in the second year, who is 2 years older, has far more experience. He held him off, And in the end, Mini ruined or overcooked his tires by trying to catch him. He, and by the way, his mother is Indian, his father is Swedish.
He's English.
And he's English. So I saw on his helmet he has now 3 flags.
I saw that also.
So I said, now we have to make, we have to reduce it. But for his age, he's very mature and a lot of confidence. Also, Lawson has a very high self-confidence. So if the best thing would to give them first a year or two at Racing Bulls and then move up to Racing Red Bull Racing. But they have, of course, to get more ready, and they can't go straight away and say we will beat Max. That was a mistake from example Gasly, who thought he's as good as Max, and then it was all the rest what was not right, and so on and so on. You have to see how Max is acting. Let's say Lindblad is 3 years away from Formula One. I guess Max is still racing at that time. But that's the next thing with Max. If he feels he doesn't enjoy it anymore, he doesn't want it, he will come to us and say, thank you, that's it. And he will stay in racing. I guess one of his dreams is to go to Le Mans with Jos. That will be an experience. I don't want to be the team principal there because we should two so strong characters, but with different approach to racing, that could be for the team principal a nightmare, but it could be a fantastic experience.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned your second driver. There are reports of a clause in Checo's contract that if he's over 100 points behind Max halfway through the half season, Red Bull can terminate the contract. Now, you are a doctor of jurisprudence. Can we get your legal opinion on this, please?
All Formula One contracts have exit clauses. Most of them are related to performance, or let's say on the top people. So, as I mentioned before, we will have an evaluation during the summer break, and then we make a decision.
And if you let him go, is Liam Lawson the next driver?
First, we have to see. Lawson is testing in Silverstone on Thursday. And, yeah, there are 2 more races, and there will be more outings with Lawson. And there's also Yuki Tsunoda, who is doing very well.
Yeah. Now, speaking of, you mentioned Pierre Gasly. I remember reading a statement that was attributed to you, saying that every time Pierre Gasly gets into the car, he wants to reinvent the vehicle. Did you say that? Or something close to it?
Yes, when he was lapped in Budapest, he wanted a different suspension. So, you know, he's not an engineer. So he was just running out of excuses. He couldn't accept that Max is just a faster guy.
Yeah, it's very hard to beat a Max or a Senna or a Schumacher. Okay, I want to ask you a question, if you don't mind. Your 2 drivers, Yuki Tsunoda and Isaac Hadjiwar, it's a lot of fun to listen to them on their team radio communication. Do you ever tell them to calm down or don't be like this?
Of course, and we had a lot of arguments with Yuki. We also brought him together with a mental trainer, because first his shouting was stupid, and then he was getting slower. That's what worried me most, you know. Yeah. And we told him, you know, if you tell an engineer the car is shit, what should he do? You must give detailed technical information, and for that you have to concentrate and find out exactly where the problems are. And now I think, but it's basically that Yuki is always, if you talk to him privately, he's he's not shouting, but he has an aggressive way of talking, and of course in the radio. And with Isaac, that's French emotion, but it has the same effect. So we also put him together with mental trainers to stop that.
Now, just last night I was watching a video with your ex-driver, Daniel Kvyat, when he was in Formula BMW, and he said he was in first test session like 4 or 5 seconds slower, and he said, I got a call from Dr. Marco at 7 in the morning saying, so you are useless in the rain, and he hung up. Is that true?
7 o'clock in the morning could be true because, you know, I'm an early bird, and in the morning all the lines are free, so you get through. I don't believe that I hang up. I say you have to improve. We don't accept such things, you know.
Yeah, very interesting. Okay, can you give us some insight into how close Red Bull came to an agreement with Porsche as engine partner, and was control of team the deal breaker?
You know, to make our own engine was a brave decision and also a very costly one. So Mr. Mateschitz was worried, first, that we can do it alone, and secondly, for the cost. So when Porsche came around, there had been some other manufacturers who contacted us for a cooperation. But Porsche, from the marketing point of view, would have been the ideal partner. In the end, it didn't work out because we had different views how that should work and how, who, and it was a 50-50 partnership, which is never easy, you know. So unfortunately, it didn't work out.
Now, Red Bull bought the F1 team from Ford, and they will be your partners starting 2026. How is that project on battery development going, and how far are you, Red Bull, in testing and development of your own power plant?
So, after the decision not to go with Porsche, we found in Ford a very good partner who didn't want to interfere in the racing details because there we are better. So we have a partnership where Ford can provide some knowledge and know-how, which is friction, turbo, for example, maybe on the battery side and so on. But they just support, and there always is a financial support. So it's a good cooperation. At the moment, we are on plan with our engine program. Everything is in time. But the problem is it's complete new regulations, you know. 50% electrical, 50% is combustion. So petrol fuel will be a big factor. First time we are using 100% e-fuel, and also the battery, how quickly you can get it into the engine. So the final regulations aren't yet there. So I don't think it will be a game changer like 2014 where Mercedes was 50 and more horsepower ahead. But you really will see once the engines are running on the track. But so far, we are on plan.
Okay. Now, this season, from the beginning, has been like a Falco song, Rock Me Amadeus. Were you surprised when Lewis announced he was leaving Mercedes to join Ferrari, or did you have some secret info on it?
There had been rumors, but especially in the winter time, there are a lot of rumors because no racing is going on. So you journalists are looking for stories. But when it was officially announced, I heard it one day before it was announced, I was really surprised. But on the other hand, for the sport, it's very good. Lewis is the most successful driver we have in history. And together, you know, even the share price went up. So you see the effect on the marketing, on the nose, on the money side. And but what happened? Normally, you start around July, August to talk about drivers for next year. And with this move from Hamilton so early, everything was earlier, you know. So most of the deals are already done. And, yeah, we'll see. Will be definitely interesting.
Then came the news of Adrian Newey leaving your team. How big of a loss is this for Red Bull? And do you know where he's going? We need a scoop, please.
Adrian was very important for Red Bull Racing. You know, he came with a knowledge how to win championships. He won with McLaren, he won with Williams. So he helped to set up the factory to get the necessary tools and how to work in, and he also brought some people with him. And what is outstanding on Adrian for me is his, or how should I say, his knowledge about everything. He's not only aerodynamics, he knows about strategy, he knows about mechanical grip and all that. And he looks at the car, and if there are problems, because of his, he's not only a computer, or he's not a computer guy at all. So, and then he...
He still uses a drawing board.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, he still uses a drawing board, and two people are transferring it on the digital work.
Wow.
So, of course, it's nowadays not one person only. And once he decided he wanted to do something different, yeah, we had to accept it. I don't know where he's going, but for sure, every team is trying to get hold of him.
Okay. Your business association with Christian Horner began when you sold him a lorry for his Formula 3000 team. What did you see in him when you put him in charge of Red Bull Formula One team at a very young age, which was very impressive? Both for him and for making that bold decision.
At that time, we had a junior team, and we put Antonio Luzzi into his team, and we won with him the F3000 championship. So I saw how he is working, how structured, and so on. And when we bought Jaguar, we got it practically for $1 or £1, I don't know exactly more which currency, but we had to take care if we lay out people, then these costs would be our side. And the boss said, we want to do it differently. And I said, okay, I have a young guy. He was no Formula One experience, so he wasn't really convinced. That's why we took Steiner, who had some experience with Jaguar before. And pretty soon it showed that Horner is a man who is innovative and is also doing the right decisions, the right strategies, and so on.
Now, earlier you used the phrase a nightmare manager if Jos and Max were in the same team. When you had your Formula 3000 team, one of your drivers was Juan Pablo Montoya. Was he a hot potato, difficult to handle and manage? And how good was his son, Sebastian, who was also in your program?
Juan Pablo, he came here to Graz. The first thing he told me that which McDonald's of the four, I didn't know that we have four McDonald's in Graz, is the best. So his sort of food was unhealthy. He was a lazy bastard.
Lazy bastard?
Yeah. But he was unbelievably fast.
Yes.
Unbelievably fast. And he did so many stupid mistakes. You know, we were leading in trucks. No, it was the first race in England. I can't remember. We were leading in Finland, and he crashed. So that's similar to his son, but his son is crashing not in the front. He's crashing more in the top 10 and so on. So we had a hard time with him for quite a lot of times. We didn't even talk to each other. But now we are good friends, and yeah, he wasted his talent. He could have been multiply world champion.
Yeah,
his son, unfortunately, doesn't have this ultimate speed like Juan Pablo, but he compensates it with crashes. He's nearly every race, unfortunately, crashing.
Yeah, I'm watching this all the time in Formula 3. Okay, now, heavy American involvement in Formula 1 these days, Liberty Media, three races in the U.S., your main sponsor, Oracle, is from U.S., your engine partner from 2026 is the second largest U.S. auto manufacturer. Important question. How can we find a happy medium to accommodate an American team called Andretti Global on the grid?
Oh, that's a difficult situation. And it's not up to us, you know. I personally think 11th team could be a benefit to Formula One.
That's good to hear.
But as always, it's a money situation. The existing 10 teams spent a hell of a money in the last decades, and now since the cost cap came, it became a business case. So it's just understandable that they don't want to take or give away any of their cake. So I think it's up to Liberty, and also if they find a solution that the existing teams are not struggling, and I mean, also there should come some value, but with the name Andretti, with the name Cadillac, I think there is a positive effect. But on the other hand, if you have 11 teams, I would believe at least at 50% of the circuits, we won't have garages for them. That is solvable. But the main thing is political, and I hope they solve it.
Okay. Austria is a small country but has made great contribution to the world of motor racing. Going back all the way to Dr. Ferdinand Porsche, Hans Schuck Sr., and Jochen Rindt, your friend, Niki Lauda, Dietrich Mateschitz, and yourself. What is the secret of this big success for such a small country?
Enthusiasm and willing to succeed. You know, there's only one car produced. It's produced here in Graz. It's Mercedes G car. Unbelievable. You have to wait 3 years to get one. But there's no automotive industry. So all the other countries, England and so on, all the drivers and the people have support. Here in Austria, we had to make our way on ourselves just with necessary enthusiasm, hard work, and know-how.
Good. Now, Stirling Moss won the 1961 German Grand Prix, and you were there as a teenager with your friend Jochen Rindt. Tell us how you got there, and what do you remember most from that weekend?
We had the last exam of our high school with 18. I failed in one
subject,
Jochen in two. So, and it was a boarding school in Bad Aussee, which is about 150 kilometers north from here. So we sit down and say, going back home, only travels with the parents and so on. Jochen had a car. So we decided, we heard there's a Grand Prix at Nürburgring. Okay, we jumped in the car, went to Nürburgring. Jochen was owner of a pepper mill, more or less. So we didn't have enough money. We stopped at his factory. He told the night porter, I'm Jochen Rindt, I own this place. Please give me 500 German or something. The guy saw two crazy ones. So he wake up. Jochen insisted, the director, and then we got the money so we can fill up the car again and went to Nürburgring. And I remember exactly, we stopped at Schwalbenschwanz. We're laying on the ground just with a coat, sleeping. And then we were, through the noise of the engines at that time, you know, you could hear the difference between a Ferrari, Cosworth, or a Matra. Matra was even the most brutal, you know. And that was the first impression. That was the first proper motor race I saw. And Jochen said, I want to do that. That's what I want to do. So I thought, okay, no, he's complete weirdo whatsoever, because in Austria we didn't have a circuit, anything like that. So fortunately, with the money he got from his factory, he started first with the Alfa, Giulietta, and then F3 and F2, and the rest we know.
So the moral of the story is, failure in school led to success on the tracks. That's beautiful. Okay, I want to show you a picture. Check this out, please. Tell us what this race is and who is this. Okay. Tell me about this race, about this event, and who did you beat to win the race?
That was Nürburgring, Nordschleife. Left to me is Niki Lauda. Right is Peter Peter, another Austrian. And we both had beaten on the podium already when he crossed the line. So I think he was 2 or 3 minutes behind. And I think, or Nick, I don't know, we broke all the records and Nicky and me were nearly lapping the whole field.
How quick was Nicky in those days?
Nicky was very quick. And I had one more year experience. So I remember I followed him till he made a mistake and then I overtook him, you know. So it was a rivalry, but it was on a good pace. We always stayed friends.
Now, when he was with Mercedes and Toto, now all three of you are Austrians, but I got the feeling that there was some tiff like a disagreement between you, Toto, and Nicky. Was it because they would not supply you Mercedes engine, or is there more to the story?
First of all, Nicky always came for breakfast to our hospitality unit, and that was the most exciting time of a Grand Prix because it was a discussion, what's going on. Of course, I didn't tell everything, he didn't tell everything, but it was no bullshit talking. And then we, with the Renault engine, it was hopeless, absolute hopeless. So...
Did Srila Bidwul ever came to you for breakfast?
No. But I had a better relationship than Christian Horner had with him. But anyway, and then our boss was not a fan of the brand Mercedes for whatever reasons. I don't.
Nashes?
Yeah. So I said, listen, I know you don't like the brand Mercedes, but I want to win. We have to win. And I believe... through Nicky, we could get an engine, that was a long discussion. And in the end, he agreed. And then we had a handshake with Nicky that we get a Mercedes engine. And that was killed by Toto Wolff. So the relationship with Toto then wasn't the best.
Okay. Now, winning the 1971 Le Mans, that beautiful Porsche, what do you remember most from that race and being on the Mulsanne Strait? Is it more fun at midnight or at high noon?
So what I remember most is we were leading the second Porsche. You know, it was our team was run from Stuttgart and the other one was run from England.
John Meyer.
There was competition. We were, I don't know, one lap ahead of the Ferrari who was third, but we were going absolute on the limit. So I went to Mr. Ferdinand Porsche, which is also a great Austrian, you know, and he was the race director at the time and said, listen, we are one lap ahead and we are racing like it would be a sprint race. So let's make an arrangement. And he said, no, the better one may win. That meant the last 3 hours, full speed. Wow. That was the one thing. Le Mans, every time of the day has its different atmosphere. You know, during the day, you see all these people running around. At evening, you smell from the grills, all this is coming in. But for driving, the most difficult time is when it's getting bright again, you know.
Early morning.
Early morning.
Interesting. Okay, you had a great run with Alfa Romeo at Targa Florio, and you described the, you know, street circuit as Nordschleife to the power of three. How much fun was driving on Italian roads in Sicily?
First of all, when I came first time, I said, that's absolutely crazy. You know, you start, it's 72 kilometers, it's going through villages, there is normal traffic, there were donkeys towing little Italian sitting on top of it with some hay. And so, unbelievable situations. First you start with your normal hire car till it breaks down, and then we get Alfa Romeo, GT, AM, or what they were racing, and then we went with a race car, you know, with a race car on the normal road. There was a policeman, pro forma. He got, a ticket. You stopped, got the ticket, poof, full speed again, you know. So, and some no guardrails, nothing. And yet the straight is, I don't know how long, I think 12 kilometers or so. That's where I lost against the Ferrari because they had the better engine. And to the race, I think there came 500,000 people. Yeah. And I was behind the Ferrari, and the people were the guardrails more or less. And there was, I said, I had to overtake him. So I just poof went. The people went fortunately backwards. And after I passed this, they closed the road again. And up in the mountains, if you would have, sometimes it took them quite a long time to find the car again because it was so steep and bushes and all that. But the atmosphere was unbelievable.
I think some years ago, you took a Porsche and Daniel Ricciardo drove at the Targa Florio?
I went there for 100 year of Targa Florio, so, and I still couldn't believe that I was racing there. And this, I didn't drive with Daniel, I can't remember. Maybe he got it, he asked me for some advice or so.
Okay, now, your involvement in new young drivers is long before Red Bull. You were involved with Gerhard Berger, and there was young Austrian Markus Hüttinger. I remember him winning a BMW M1 race. How good was he?
He was very good. He was one of these rare talents coming from Burgenland, which is the smallest country here. Also no money, no racing history. And, you know, he got this unbelievable accident where a wheel just hit him when he was driving on the straight and broke his neck. But there was another one, Helmut Koenig as well, who was killed in Watkins Glen. So at this time, I was wondering if I'm doing the right thing, you know, helping this young. But that if I won't do it, someone else would do it. And the risk at that days was much higher. Yeah. Fortunately, that changed a lot. And now, you know, there was a very good book from a Czech company, when sex was safe and racing dangerous. Yeah. I was always very good photos.
Can I ask you three more questions, please?
But then we have to, yeah.
Thank you. Okay, Red Bull has given many young drivers from all over the world opportunity to showcase their talent. One driver that you let go surprised me was Robert Wickens. What was your assessment of him as a race car driver, and especially at the time you released him?
Witkins, I discovered him in, I think, Montreal.
Formula BMW.
And he was a little bit, or quite stubborn. And he just didn't develop in the way I expected it from him.
That's it.
He didn't bring the results.
Okay. Your whole life has been dedicated to motor racing. I would like you to share one interesting moment. Why did you and two other guys carry Mike Hailwood to his hotel room after the South African Grand Prix? I believe it was 72.
It was 72, yes.
We need the full story, please.
We both had problems with our cars.
Okay.
And so we met at the bar, and we had some drinks. Mike more than the others, so he couldn't walk anymore, and we had to carry him. And you know, a drunk person is really difficult to carry because it slips away. Yeah. So some journalists, it was four people, we brought him to his room. I think he slept in his clothes, and next day he was leading the race till a stupid mistake took him out of the race.
Very interesting. And, you know, he was from motorcycle. Mark Marquez is another great Red Bull champion. Have you thought of putting him in a single-seater and see if he can do a John Surtees win both on two and four wheels?
We put him in a Formula One car. We had a test with him and Dani Pedrosa. But at that stage, he was still fully committed to motorcycle, and now I think he's too old.
Yeah. Now, looking back at your very successful life in racing and business, what are you most happy and proud of?
I'm most happy that I survived, because in the time when I was racing, it was really dangerous, and this accident when a stone hit my eye, you know, to manage the situation, I was six or something like that, 20 cars behind, 280 kilos of fuel on board. So that was a very critical moment. I'm happy what I'm doing. I'm enjoying, and for me, work is not a... I enjoy working, you know. So it's not like people say, oh, you have to go here or you have to fly. I sleep on the plane, so...
Thank you so much.
Pleasure.
Very nice of you for your time.
Dr. Marco owns four hotels in Graz. His office is across the street from one of his hotels, which is called Schlossberg Hotel, which is where I was staying after the interview. He asked me when I was leaving. I told him tomorrow, so he said, okay, let me introduce you to my daughter at the hotel. She can give you some travel ideas. Where I was staying is in the very historical Schlossberg area, so thanks to his daughter Poppy, I was able to do a nice walking tour and really enjoyed it. Now here is a shout out to our man, Tech Talk Tim. He is a purveyor of Persian food, and right on the same street as Dr. Marco's office, just a minute walk away, is a mighty fine Persian restaurant called Saffron. Needless to say, I ate there, and yes, they do have grilled tomato. So if Tech Talk or any of our listeners who are interested in making a trip to Graz, there is some fine dining here.
Hi, this is Mika Häkkinen, double Formula One world champion. All the best for the readers, F1 Weekly.
Now we move on to more. Silverstone success for Sir Hamilton. Historic ninth win at Silverstone is bringing a lot of kudos for Sir Win-a-Lot. He is the first driver to have won a Grand Prix after 300 starts. His first victory came 17 years ago, proving there is still bite in this old dog. Here are the numbers from his home track. Since 2014, he has been on the podium every year. In 2018, he was P2. In 2022 and 23, he was P3. Rest of the years, P1, baby. Off the tracks, currently on the calendar, there are only three where LCH has not won a race yet. the two new American tracks, Miami and Vegas, and Zandvoort in the Netherlands. 83 Grand Prix wins just with Mercedes. I think at the end of the season in Abu Dhabi, he will get on the radio on the final lap and say, "Toto, it's called Tata." Looking ahead to the Hungarian Grand Prix this weekend, it will be a cold day in Congo if Max does not win in three straight races. If this happens, it will be confirmation that barbarians have opened the gate. JB got his first win here. I think it will be goulash good if OP gets his first win in the Hungarian Grand Prix. I am expecting a cutthroat competition between Max, Lando, and the two Mercedes drivers. A penalty-free podium is all I ask for. Now we come to I note with interest. Last weekend, Kimi Antonelli took his first win in Formula 2 in Saturday's sprint race. In the feature race on Sunday, he was taken out on the opening lap by Indian driver Kush Maini. Shall we call him the new cucumber? This is what Toto Wolff had to say, and I quote, "Today it was DNF, but it wasn't his fault. Susie always says, you qualify with numpties, you race with numpties," end quote. Well, quite a reference to a racing driver previously known as Susie Stoddard. Her DTM career was as successful as Hilly Deegan in NASCAR. What do you note with interest, Mr. Rogers, apart from El Bachismo de Oviedo, Fernando Alonso? Earlier in the podcast, I mentioned with Mugello Circuit, I am sure all our listeners remember during the COVID era, we had a Grand Prix here and the track is owned by Ferrari. This is a very beautiful part of Italy, but very, very hot this weekend. I am doing an Airbnb and this place is very, very remote. You just keep driving through the hills, then you feel like, then you go through a dirt road for a mile or two. Place is really good if you want to run away from everybody and want peace and quiet, but you cannot go down the street for some jalapeno poppers or cheeseburgers. And sir, Friday, I was able to do an interview with Ferrari Jr., Tuukka Toppinen. And we have mentioned his name on the show a few times, and he is a very quick driver and member of the Ferrari Driver Academy. I also had a brief chat with David Larini. His papito is Nicola Larini, who raced in Formula One and won the DTM championship with Alfa Romeo. He was not at the track when I met the kid, but hopefully I will see him on Saturday and we'll try to do an interview. Sunday, I'm driving back to Milano. It's about a four-hour drive from here, and my flight to Nice is on Monday. I was trying to go to the Maserati Museum on Sunday, but they are closed on weekends. But the Alfa Romeo Museum in Arese near Milan is open. I have been there before, but it's definitely worth a visit again. So I will try to get there on Sunday. With that, we say ciao, ciao, and we will rejoin the family next week behind the palatial walls of F1 Weekly, both on the left and right coast. Thank you. Bye-bye.